Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
So since the last time Will Cosentini came on, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, retired, I met his mom. I never met his mom before. And I'm now friends with your mom. Do you like that? Do you not like that? What do you think of that?
No, it's good. She's, you know, one of the all-time great people.
Pat. That's right. Actually, when she first texted me, I thought it was your dad. And I said, well, you and your wife raised a great son, right? I thought I was lying to your dad right away to get in his good graces to get more information on you. And the text came back, well, actually, this is Will's mother. And I went, oops, sorry about that. Now, but she did tell me this. She said she knew why you joined the Marine Corps and that I should ask you about it again. And she reminded you. So... you came on. The last time you were on, you said you didn't know why you joined the Marine Corps. Now you evidently do. So what was it?
Yeah, so apparently we had a family discussion sometime, and this is like the early 70s, maybe even before that. And the discussion was if, you know, there's a big war, what are you going to do? And I said, well, you know, I'm going to join the Marine Corps because like those guys on Gomer Pyle, all they do is march around all day. That seems pretty good. So that's the family lore of why I joined the Marine Corps.
You're the first person in going into the fifth year of this program that has ever said I joined because of Gomer Pyle.
There you go. I'm unique. You didn't know that?
You are the antithesis of Gomer Pyle, though. That is, like, look, I know Gomer Pyle, and I know Gomer Pyle's in the Marine Corps. You are not a Gomer Pyle. I don't know. Why would you identify with that guy?
And again, somehow it got blocked out.
Golly,
sorry. That conversation, and whenever the decision was made sometime later than that.
Golly, Sarge is not you.
There you have it.
What? Shazam? That is not you, my friend. All right. Well, whatever. Well, you know what? It's an awesome story. It's a great story. Now, you mentioned the early 70s. I was thinking about this. In fact, I just looked it up. I can vividly remember. For those people who don't know, this is my prediction. You're about to see some Watergate-esque shit. And I'm older than Will by a few years. And I just looked it up. I was 15 years old at the time, but I was interested, and I'll never forget coming home today, and it was late in the day on the West Coast when they voted on the articles of impeachment in the House Judiciary Committee. It was a Watergate, right? The Senate, the House and the Senate Watergate committees. Sam Ervin and Peter Rodino and Howard Baker and people like that. And the somber looks on their faces. But the lead up to all this, in my opinion, is you're watching something very similar today, which was, well, the president's not involved, though. Surely the president's not involved. Sure, you know. And then it was his secretary, Rosemary Woods. There was an erased segment where he was getting to talk to somebody about this. And nobody could figure out what happened. And it was Rose Woods said, oh, maybe my leg, right, brushed up against the switch to turn the recording device on, blah, 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 blah. But it was stunning revelation after stunning revelation after stunning revelation. And what we learned late last week is Barack Obama, he, you know, chaired a meeting talking about with subordinates not to talk about this with the Trump administration that was incoming. And so I don't know what most of you would call that, but to me, you're dancing around the C word, right? Which is conspiracy.
Yeah, and a slight nuance. I don't think anyone ever tied Nixon to giving direction for the break-in in Watergate. But I think it was pretty obvious that he gave direction on, the cover-up.
Right.
This time, it appears that the president may have been in on genesis of this whole thing. And that's a little bit of a nuance, but it's also a huge difference.
Stunning, too. I mean, to me, last week was...
Why stunning?
I never connected him... Right. I never connected, Barack Obama with the plumbers. Right. I didn't.
But who were the plumbers? I mean, the plumbers in Nixon's time, G. Gordon Liddy was, low level functionary, et cetera.
Right.
The plumbers in this case, Susan Rice, Samantha Powers, James Comey, Clapper. Those are people that, with the exception of Powers. Those are people that he sees, talks to, or gets information from 6 days out of seven.
Call me naive, okay? Call me naive. I was stunned when his name and, what you're talking about is an orchestration meeting. Well, what would they be orchestrating? A cover-up. To cover up this.
Mac, you're just a racist.
This and like all of a sudden Barack Obama emerges all of a sudden when his name comes out and
also notice what the president said. So this is the famed constitutional lawyer,
right?
Editor of the Harvard Law Review. He says, well, the rule of law is in peril because when someone pleads to perjury and gets off, Flynn never pled to perjury. So he deliberately misstates what the issue is. What are the odds that anyone out there who watches, NBC, et cetera, is ever going to think one step beyond? They're not. So he's absolutely spinning this to ensure that the narrative remains in place.
And so if you weren't alive during the Watergate thing, hold on to your hat because you're going to see some shit as these documents come out. I mean, it's disillusioning or illuminating or whatever. But so you see what these people said in front of the American public, and then you see what they said in their sworn statement.
The thing though. What happens with this election? Right?
You mean the upcoming?
If Biden wins, what happens to all this stuff?
Biden's not going to win.
Well, if the Democrats win, what happens to all this stuff?
Oh, it'll be buried.
It goes right back into the rabbit hole.
Right. But Biden's not going to win. He's got his son hanging around his neck. Right. He's got a rape allegation hanging around his neck. And now he is going to be the bystander to a conspiracy that he did nothing to stop. At some point, if anybody of any substance says, hey, hold on a second. We all know that dossier is bullshit. If this ever comes to light, or we can't base these FISA applications on that. Right.
They did.
Well, I know, but so he's the bystander to that. And with all that junk in your trunk, right, you're going to get elected president of the United States? I don't see it. I don't see it. Write it down. Write that shit down, Cosentini.
All right, there you go. May 12th, 11:20, God's time, in the middle of the country here.
There you go. All right, first of all, just so everybody knows, Will is qualified to talk about the new Secretary of the Navy. For two reasons. One, he went to the Naval Academy. Okay, so that makes him qualified. That means, first of all, he's in the upper 1%. What is it actually? What are you guys that go to the academies? Where do you, like, what percentile? Not you specifically, because I know you lowered the threshold, but the best and brightest, what percent are they of the American academic population?
You know, how do you slice that up?
Come on, give it up.
I mean, I think Navy is somewhere in the top 20 or so schools.
Okay,
top all 20. The service academies are. And so, you know, my class was about 1,130 or 40 upon admission, and they probably had, I don't know, 15,000 or so applications, but that doesn't really give you a sense.
How many graduated out of the 1,100 that start?
I want to say 1028. Something like that.
20%
attrition, something wow. on that order.
That's impressive. That's not bad.
Yeah. I mean, you're starting with a pretty good, you know, I think everyone who gets in is absolutely capable of graduating. And some people sort of choose different paths, and some people get hurt, some people get sick, some people get in trouble. So, yeah, 20%.
All right. So, but we're essentially talking about you know, people that can swim in the deep end, and obviously Will can. So I just want to establish his intellectual credentials. So he's a Naval Academy guy, and he also worked in the E-ring, okay? So could you explain what the E-ring is?
So geographically, the Pentagon is 5 stories above ground, and then it's the building is built with 5 concentric rings. So the innermost ring is the A ring, and the outermost ring is the E ring. And all the service secretaries and the service chiefs have their offices out on that outer ring, the E ring. I think because it's the only one that's got windows on the outside.
I was going to say, is that the reason?
Well, you know, interesting. I did 3 tours in the Pentagon.
Get out.
I must have been a concentration camp guard in my previous life.
I know.
This is what I reincarnated to. And so it wasn't until my last job there in the assistant commandant's office that I actually had a window on the outside. And from my window, if you looked hard left, you could see Arlington Cemetery. If you looked hard right, you could see the Washington Monument. The funny thing is I really didn't have a whole lot of time to look out the window at that point. But that may be it, you know.
Dead center out of
her. Heard this though. When my daughter heard this, she said, "Dad, you're a somebody now."
Hey, my favorite daughter said that. The and so straight out of your window would have been the Lincoln Memorial.
Yeah, slightly off to the right. Yeah,
wow.
My window is about 16 inches wide.
Hey.
So you really. Look hard left and hard right to see.
It's
anything.
Not really, just so you know, it was built to be a firing port in case we have to defend the rampart. So just that's why that accounts for the small aperture. So anyway, those are Will's credentials in terms of talking about he's lived in the E-ring and he's a graduate of the Naval Academy. Admiral Brathwaite is going to come to a Navy that, I don't know, has been, I won't say reeling, but stumbling for years in the leadership realm, and he's also going to probably face some funding issues relative to what we've done with the COVID-19 funding and the what many thought were going to be the inevitable contraction of the budget. Give me your general thoughts, and I played his opening statement there. It was interesting. You know, what he said straight out of the chute, talking about his father, who went ashore at Normandy and, you know, what duty, honor, commitment,
honor, courage, commitment,
his consistent use of that, of those 3 words, characterizing his service, your thoughts on him as the next prospective Secretary of the Navy.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of things, I'll take some dissect the statement a little bit and then talk about some general stuff.
Okay, and then what we'll do is I'm going to play Will probably three audio clips, and then we'll talk about some of the particulars that get said, which are kind of interesting little things that he gets asked during his hearing. So that's how we'll do the first part of this.
Just, you know, the Secretary of the Navy, and this is where I think sometimes the public and even people inside the building get confused sometimes. When you talk about the Navy, are you talking about the United States Navy or the Secretary of the Navy? Because the Secretary of the Navy, the Department of the Navy, is the only department that's got two military services in it. The United States Navy and the United States Marine Corps.
Well, hold on. That's not true anymore, though. The Air Force has the Space Force now.
Okay, yes. The Space
Force. I love that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
For your correction. but when people say space, they know what you're talking about. When they say Air Force, they know what you're talking about. That being said, you know, in his statement, he said the Department of the Navy is in rough waters.
Ooh.
And then he only cited United States Navy issues with that. The Roosevelt, the Fat Albert, the collisions out in Westpac. And that, it might be subtle, but it's actually somewhat telling about how the Secretariat of the Navy often works, is that the Navy inside the Secretariat, the United States Navy, is the big brother, right? Their budget, the United States Navy's budget, is somewhere 140-odd billion, 150 billion. The Marine Corps' budget is 35 or 40 billion. So they get the preponderance of the Secretary's attention. The Secretariat staff, the Department of the Navy staff, is typically much more populated with senior uniformed Navy officers. There are some Marine generals occasionally in the Secretariat, but they are very much the exception. In no way are they in the ratio of a service that's a quarter of the budget. And, you know, I'd argue in the last 20 years, but particularly in the years of 2002 to 2008, 10, 12, I mean, the Marine Corps was the one doing the work. And so it's just interesting to me that he used those words and coming from a former Navy admiral, that doesn't surprise me. And that can mean a couple of things to the Marine Corps, in that if he's totally focused on the Navy, the U.S. Navy, can be a good thing, but it can be a bad thing in light of what we'll talk about next, force design, in that if General Berger wants to see his vision come about, the Secretary of the Navy is the first guy that he's got to win over, and he's going to need significant attention from the Secretary to be able to do anything. And the Secretary didn't go in and talk about the Marine Corps. He talked about the Navy.
Okay, to your point, he doesn't even say the words Marine Corps.
No, he doesn't.
In the whole hearing.
And to be fair to the guy, look, the reason he is the Secretary designate is because the U.S. Navy and the Secretaries of the Navy in the last, I don't know, year or two, et cetera, have not really covered themselves in glory. So he recognizes he's got to stop the bleeding. That being said, you would hope that someone that is that accomplished and that's coming in has got to recognize you're a secretary of two services, and this other service can't be the other service, you know, who sits at the kids' table when it comes to Thanksgiving dinner. And he didn't win a lot of my affection and admiration when he goes in there and doesn't even mention the Marine Corps. I'll say the other thing, I think his statement up front was bold in saying, hey, we've got a problem. You know, good for him. I'm glad he said that.
We've got a leadership problem, right?
Absolutely. We've got a leadership problem. But then I got to tell you, he backs off it a little bit. And he said, you know, the culture is tarnished. Well, if the culture's honor, courage, and commitment, the culture can't be tarnished. The culture, the thought of the culture is exactly correct. What's tarnished is the reputation of the people upholding it. And again, that might be nuanced, but, you know, damn, man, you're standing up there and saying something and laying out exactly where you want to go. In his words, they should be able to be parsed and not find this sort of daylight in there. And then the last thing on this big issue of leadership in the Navy. So how long is he going to be the secretary? You know, if the president gets reelected, you know, the longest he'll be the secretary is about 5 years. And how does the secretary of the Navy impact United States Navy leadership? When you get right down to it, he gets a vote, really the deciding vote, on who the 3 stars and the 4 stars are going to be. You know, he doesn't go down there and pick lieutenant commanders and midshipmen to go to the Naval Academy and all that stuff. And so he's got, you know, best case, 5 years to send a message out on the type of people that he wants to be in those 3 and 4 star positions to run that. Well, really, he's going to be on the margin to do that. It's really hard. You know, we'll use the old adage of the aircraft carrier. It doesn't turn real fast. And even 5 years of picking senior uniforms, first, what's the pool of people? Well, they've grown up in this same leadership deficit Navy. I don't read, you know, proceedings, and I don't really pay attention to a lot of stuff that's going on inside the Navy at that level. But I don't, can you name one or two star admiral out there that you say should be the next CNO, you know, to come in and really take charge and straighten things out? You know, his ability to redirect the service, Admiral Gilday has been in for what, not even a year. He's going to be there for the next 3. So it's really going to be hard to operationalize what he said. And my prediction is that he's going to get involved in what the Secretary of the Navy always gets involved in. It's the knife fight of the budget inside the building. And his ability to really change that, to make that culture what he says it's going to be, it's really hard to do. And if you listen to the rest of the testimony, which, I mean, I guess we'll get into, you know, the senators really, they don't get into that with them. You know, you get some people worrying about their, about this shipyard kind of a thing. I mean, really, at the secretary's hearing, that's what you want to talk about.
How about the fuel tanks in Pearl Harbor?
Exactly. You know, that's what I mean. And then the second thing is you get, in this point, I don't know if you got the clip teed up or not, but someone, and I forget who it was, makes some pretty strong accusations against the president.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna play that one. It was she's the former Army officer, Tammy Duckworth, Senator Duckworth from Illinois.
Yeah. Braithwaite, he by his silence, he almost accepts her premise. And, well, you know, you want to be really careful, you're up there, you gotta get confirmed, blah, blah, blah. This is all political white noise. Well, that's not Trumpism, right? Trump doesn't take that crap. And so the idea that his secretary is going to allow people to slander the president with no pushback.
Right.
He merely, when she lays out the premise and then says, are you going to do bad things? And he says, no.
And it starts with, it's very Kamala Harris-like in terms of prosecutorial. She's just using him as a stooge, right? Do you believe that good order and discipline is a requirement for the United States military? Yes, I do. Do you believe? And then she says, therefore, you, when the President of the United States says this, and he's like, blah, blah. So that's what Will's talking about. And no pushback. He doesn't even say anything like, I don't necessarily agree with your conclusion here. But let me just address the substance of your question. He doesn't say anything like that.
And of interest, in one of my previous lives, I worked for a guy who was the assistant to the chairman. And his primary duty as directed by the chairman was he was the military advisor to the Secretary of State. And so we traveled with Condoleezza Rice, you know, 18 months I was there. And one of the things I used to do is when you'd go somewhere to a country and she'd have a series of meetings, and then typically there'd be a press conference with the foreign minister of that country, and there'd be U.S. press and there'd be foreign press. And it was interesting to me, very often a foreign press would direct a question to their foreign secretary, which was really a slander against the United States. And then that foreign minister would say something, and then someone would ask a question of Condoleezza Rice. And on more than one occasion, before she answered that question, she would address the question that had been directed to the foreign minister and take umbrage with a characterization of the United States. Nobody took pot shots at her country. And I give her a lot of credit for that because she's trying to be diplomatic, and typically we're in a country, we're trying to improve relations, we're trying to get them to do something for us, but she doesn't take crap about the United States. People don't get to throw rocks at us without being called out on it. And I think that the secretary designate had an opportunity there to show that I get it. These people are politically aligned against the president, and he needs to, you know, curry favor might be the wrong word with senators, but he needs to get people to vote for what he wants to do in the Navy. But if you sacrifice the messaging part of that, I don't know. That's, you know, the secretary should go in there and be a warrior for that kind of stuff. And I think he missed an opportunity to set a tone with the senators on that.
Do you? I wonder if the president saw that. He watched a lot of TV, man. I wonder if he saw it or if somebody brought that to his attention. Because
it didn't make TV. You had to be someone like you digging around in the Senate Armed Services Committee transcripts. There's about 9 people in the country who do that. So,
well, you know what? I don't.
You're
know.
One of the 9.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not happy. I'm not happy about that. That's for sure. I'm never that guy. Okay, I want to play. So, with all that said, this is Senator Reid, the ranking Democratic member. His question to Ambassador Brathwaite.
No, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Ambassador, you made it very clear in the opening statement that the Navy chain of command is in disarray. Nothing illustrates that more than the Roosevelt situation, when an acting Secretary of the Navy is calling directly a carrier commander and trying to work out problems with him, something's wrong. And when that carrier commander's immediate superior is several staterooms down the hall and there's no apparent communication, something is wrong. It goes to trust, as you alluded to. It goes to the culture of the Navy. It goes to reliance upon the chain of command by civilian authorities of getting advice and supporting them, et cetera. And it's also, I think, in your position, keeping your eyes and the Navy's eyes focused on the threat and the force, the fleets at sea and all the force, and not being distracted by some of the things that happened here in Washington. But what specific steps are you going to take to correct this situation? Because without a functioning chain of command, without a culture of trust and confidence, the platforms are irrelevant.
Senator, I would agree with you, and I thank you for the question. As I learned in over the course of my career, again, in both the public and private sector, culture trumps everything. As Mr. Drucker, a famous entrepreneur, says, culture eats strategy for breakfast. So culture is the one thing that creates for an organization a sense of belonging, a sense of good order and discipline. It is my number one priority, if I'm confirmed, to restore the appropriate culture in the United States Navy. Culture exists. I won't say it's broken. I think it's been tarnished. I think the events over the last several years have helped see that occur. And if I'm confirmed, I will make sure that I get at that. Again, predicated on good order and discipline, empowering people to understand their responsibilities along that chain of command, as you and I both talked about yesterday, as well as setting the tone here from the very highest level. I think it's contingent upon leadership first to establish that and then hold those who are responsible throughout the chain for the same.
Thank you. Senator Blumenthal.
All right, Will. Thoughts on that?
Well, he didn't answer the question, right? And what I think Levin was trying to do is get him to say, I'm not going to jump down into the chain of command. And, you know, this deserves some discussion. When you're on the top, you don't just pass orders down and then just take stuff that comes back up. You part of your job is to, you know, supervise. And sometimes that means you get down on the low level and ask questions down there. If you cut people out in the chain of command consistently, well, then they're not going to execute. But I think as a service secretary, you're setting a tone and a culture. But at some point, the idea that I'm never going to go down and ask people questions on the deck plates is stupid. So Levin was trying to set up Braithwaite to really indict everything that happened. And, oh, by the way, I don't think the investigation's done yet. So I'm not sure we actually know exactly what happened. On the sentiment, my desire to reach down five levels in the chain of command and direct everything that's going on, no, that's not an appropriate use of the chain of command. But being visible and asking good questions and seeking information at different levels in the chain of command, I think that's what's required of a leader. I mean, you know, we saw it with General Mattis in Iraq. He didn't just listen, you know, get his information from his regimental commanders. He went out and he saw things. I mean, as a battalion commander, I didn't wait for my staff to tell me things and company commanders to tell me things. We gave orders and direction. And then we went out and supervised, and we asked questions sometimes, and sometimes we modified those orders on the scene. I think that's all completely appropriate. So it's not a black and white type of thing. Did the acting secretary go too far and completely cut out the chain of command in things that should have been of interest to the uniforms? Out there at St. Pac or at PAC Fleet and 7th Fleet. And I think that he probably did. So, you know, the hearing is set up in many ways for a yes or no answer. I give Braithwaite credit for not really answering the question, because it was a bit of a setup of a question. The other thing is sort of interesting. Levin's premise says, well, we acknowledge the Navy has a problem. And so if the problem's in the leadership, but what Levin is saying is that he should just listen to what the leadership has to tell him. Well, that's a recipe for continued problems if the problem's been with the leadership, isn't it? So, you know, you don't want to make a fool out of the ranking member on there, but it's a stupid question for
but this is all made for TV, right? Because they've done the private thing in the office. Now we're going to do the public thing, right?
Oh yeah.
Right. So
yeah.
Here's what I found interesting about that was Reed says when his superior officer is right down the hall and there's no communication. Nobody's ever said that before. right? That there was no communication between the CEO of the Roosevelt and the strike group. You know,
I think pundits may have inferred that. Right. I'm not sure that that's accurate. And again,
but I mean, there's a senator, U.S. senator, saying it, right?
Yeah. So. Which
no, it was in public, which I thought was interesting. The other thing that I think is interesting is you say you won't go down there, right? All right. And you won't, you're not going to, you know, get your 8,000 foot screwdriver out, because really what you're in the business is you're leading leaders, which is different than being, right, a corporal or a sergeant where you get your hands on them. You're leading leaders who all have a piece of the pie. That's a different art. So how about when it gets on Twitter? How about when it gets video on Twitter and Facebook, and it's all over the news, and will you make that promise? Because what we see is, right, I mean, take this investigation in Georgia. It's a Georgia issue until that video comes out and blows it up, and that's the world that we live in, right?
Yeah, but I think that, you know, Braithwaite's a PAO guy. He's been an ambassador. Those things, just because someone asks you a question doesn't mean you got to answer what they ask you. You can set a proper tone, and you don't have to react to those things if you actually care about the institution and how things are going to come out on the end. The immediate reaction to video is almost always the wrong reaction, because video is just narrow, right? You don't know what happened before, you don't know what happened after, and you don't know what happened on the sides of that. Right. And so someone setting you up by look at this video and react to it is...
Well, Chuck Todd did it over the weekend, right? Clip the attorney general.
No, he didn't do it. He did that with mouth and forth.
Right. You don't get in this business without understanding, you know, how we're going to edit this thing. And so that guy, and I want to talk about a New York guy, an upstate New York guy, Tim Russert, that guy sits in Tim Russert's chair, which he really doesn't, and he never has. Tim Russert's chair would swallow that, you know, that clown up in a heartbeat. You know,
but think about it. How many people who actually watch that show, I mean, what, there's 50 of them in the United States,
right?
Are ever going to see the rebuttal to that? And what Todd did was, you know, standard journalistic malpractice. And he got called out on it. He's obviously wrong about it. And they said, oh, we made a mistake. No, stop it. That was absolutely done with malice there. And why would anyone take anything that he ever said again? It's insane.
Well, I'll tell you why. Because when you're not interested in the truth, then the whole dynamic changes, I think.
Yeah. I think.
All right, let me play. This is Senator Jody Ernst. I think she's from Iowa. She's a former lieutenant colonel in the United States Army. And so this is Jody Ernst.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time and your commitment, and I want to give a special shout-out to your families as well. We wish they could be here with you. I know they are with you in spirit. Ambassador Braithwaite, thank you. We had a great conversation yesterday, and given maybe another day, we could have solved many of the world's problems. But I do appreciate your time and attention to a number of very important issues and regions. And part of the discussion that I found very fascinating was your perspective, not only as a naval officer, but also as an ambassador now. And serving in Norway and the close proximity to Russia, you have been able to see up close Russia's intentions in that region. And you went on to describe the posturing of Russia as well as we talked about Indo-PACOM with China and comparing what Russia is doing compared with China and where they would like to see themselves positioned globally. If you could share that discussion using your perspective as a naval officer and an ambassador, and where you think we need to be positioning as a Navy in regards to Russia and then in regards to China.
Well, thank you for that question, Senator, and especially for your time yesterday. I enjoyed our conversation as well. I've spent a lot of time in the Arctic, both as a U.S. ambassador as well as a naval officer, and I've come to appreciate that part of the world for the importance, and especially it emerges, is becoming more important to everybody. And most people in America don't realize, because we don't see that here within the continental United States, although Senator Sullivan sees it a little bit up in Alaska, but the Chinese and the Russians are everywhere, especially the Chinese. You'd be alarmed at the amount of Chinese activity off the coast of Norway in the high north. And we need to be vigilant to that. We need to understand why. My old boss, General Mattis, who I had the great fortune to work for at Joint Forces Command when I was a young Navy captain, he and I spoke just a couple years ago about this, that Russia's hope is to be relevant again on the world stage, where we all believe or all come to understand that China wants to be dominant on that same world stage. And they have really pressed hard upon Norway to be part of that calculus. If you look at the Northern Sea Route between Kirkenes, the most northern city in Norway, coming across the top of Russia, it could reduce the amount of commerce moved out of China to European markets by half. China has launched a charm campaign to try to win Norway over after, in 2010, forcing them or trying to force them to withdraw the Nobel Peace Prize to a Chinese dissident by the name of Li Shibo. The Norwegians are proud people, independent people. They stood up against the Chinese, and they suffered for that economically. But China now recognizes the importance of Kirkenes, securing a western terminus on our northern sea route, and they are up there and trying to, again, win over the people of northern Norway. The United States Navy, as you and I discussed, Senator, is at the vanguard of that. It provides some of the only capabilities to be able to do power projection in that part of the world. We are there. We currently have three destroyers that are sailing along with both the United Kingdom Navy as well as the Royal Norwegian Navy to ensure that that power projection exists, and deterrence is part of the calculus for those of us in NATO. And I think we need to continue to do that. We continue to need to be vigilant. We need to be present. And that requires an adequate-sized Navy to be there.
No, thank you very much.
All right. So did he say anything of significance in that response?
Well, what didn't he say?
He said everything.
No, what didn't he say? He didn't say USMC.
Oh.
A deterrence. We've got prepositioned equipment in Norway. We're going to sail three destroyers up there, and that's going to be deterrent. I mean, again, you know, she pitches the question towards U.S. Navy. He's the Secretary of the Department of the Navy. He's got two services. In theory, the Marine Corps is pivoting to counter this Chinese threat, and he doesn't have the wherewithal to even sneak in the two words Marine Corps into that thing. I mean, that should be either of grave concern or great joy if you're a Marine. The Secretary is not going to pay attention to us. That can be good or bad. But if we talk about force design, if we end up getting into it, you know, the Commandant has talked about being part of this naval campaign, and the Secretary of the Navy, on his first chance to talk about it, doesn't even cross his mind.
So you would find that concerning, yay?
Well, if I'm the Commandant, and I think that the way ahead is to be part of this integrated naval campaign, you know, the Commandant asks the question, what does the U.S. Navy want from us? I think it's a horrible question. That being said, well, the Secretary of the Navy doesn't seem to want anything from us. That should concern you. It'd be real easy for the Marine Corps to be the bill payer. there. And I'll tell you, I hate the word young Navy. Have you ever met a young Navy captain? I just never have. I hate that term.
I guess when you're 70, maybe they're all young. But when you're actually young, that's like people who say that 60 is the new 30. Like, yeah, people that are 28 don't say that, okay?
I mean, you can vouch, Mac. I was an old first lieutenant.
So. He was an old grumpy. I want to give you a chance to respond to Jeff Kenney, since we're talking about you as a first. You required lieutenants junior to you to address you as sir when you were the XO of a company at Camp Lejeune?
No, I had the presence, and they felt the requirement.
But Kenny did not?
Jeff is as old as they come.
He is father time, as a matter of fact. But the truth is, you said they just did it and you let them?
Of course.
Then that was the requirement they felt. Interesting. All right, here's another one. Interesting, your comment. Here's a Senator Blumenthal, former Marine. From
Find that man's recruiter.
from the Nutmeg State.
There you go. We know people from the Nutmeg
we
State.
We know Paul Kennedy. Exactly.
And
Jeff Kenney.
Thank you, Senator Blumenthal.
Finally, on the issue of trust, which is critical, I welcomed your commitment yesterday to follow the recommendations of the ongoing investigation regarding Captain Crozier's removal and to return him to command if that's the appropriate recommendation from the investigation that's now underway. I've recommended an Inspector General investigation, which may follow if necessary, but thank you for your commitment in that regard as well.
I look forward to the investigation, and I believe that Chairman Milley was correct. I believe in, as we discussed yesterday, that whenever you're confronted with a challenge like this, it's best to pause, consider all the facts, and then make the right decision. I learned that in flight school as a young naval aviator, that whenever any bell or whistle went off in your cockpit, the most important thing to do was sit on your hands for 2 seconds. And my Marine on-wing instructor made sure I did that, because then you can assess the problem correctly before shutting down the wrong system.
I found it interesting. Blumenthal's trying to box him in, like, you're going to follow whatever the investigation recommends or whatever. And I thought it was interesting that his response was, I support Chairman Milley's recommendation to do a full investigation, which in my opinion was a vote of no confidence for the CNO, because that's not what the CNO recommended.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on that?
Well, first, Blumenthal and trust in the same sentence.
It's a reach, to say the least.
I'll parse very carefully here. It's important to consider all the facts. Well, you can wait forever to get all the facts. I just say that. And the secretary, and how things work is odd, right? The CNO works for the secretary, but he's a member of the Joint Chiefs. And in many ways, the who commands an aircraft carrier is very strictly a U.S. Navy and Department of the Navy issue that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs really is uninterested in, doesn't get a vote on, shouldn't care. And now somehow we've got the chairman being the guy who's the voice to look at this in a different way. And so it's really odd how that works. And I think that, how could Braithwaite finesse this in a slightly different way to ensure that he is publicly in support of the CNO? That would have been a tough, circle to get squared up there. but just on the soundbite aspect of it, I think it could easily be interpreted. A vote of no confidence is pretty strong, but he didn't go out of his way to help out his CNO.
Yeah, and again, it's just the nature of these public hearings, right? You know, right? It's like, what am I going to try to? And that was after they talked about you know, building another submarine in Groton and some other stuff, and but it was just interesting how he tried to pin him in. This is the last audio clip, and you may have to come back and do the. And do force design, because I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it on the cheap. I don't want to not devote the appropriate time to it, because it's a serious subject. The all right. So one more. That was Blumenthal. I don't know who this senator is. So forgive me for that.
Admiral Braithwaite, I appreciated our conversation the other day, and I want to ask you a question. It just strikes me as unusual. You talked in your opening statement about the choppy waters that the Navy is in from a leadership standpoint. This strikes me as unusual. The Secretary of the Navy, Secretary Spencer, somebody who I had high regard for, was essentially relieved in the middle of a personnel battle. Military discipline was being carried out against a Navy SEAL based upon other sailors coming forward with allegations about that individual, which is extremely difficult to do. The president decided to intervene in that military justice process. The Secretary of the Navy then, trying to maintain some harmony in the ranks, started to work with the White House to try to work that out. He was eventually relieved of the position. But he was involved in a personnel matter deep within the organization, one that was very, very important. The acting Secretary of the Navy was recently relieved for involving himself in an individual personnel matter. Captain Crozier was doing what he thought he needed to do to keep folks on the Roosevelt safe. There was an ongoing investigation into the situation on the Roosevelt, but Acting Secretary Moodley sort of predetermined the investigation and made the decision on his own, apparently without the agreement of CNO Gilday, to terminate Captain Crozier from his leadership of the Roosevelt. These two incidents back-to-back with the last secretary in the acting made me sort of rethink the whole question of what is the civilian secretary's responsibility? What should it be with respect to personnel matters? That a civilian secretary would have policy responsibility broadly for personnel within the Navy is obvious. We would want a civilian secretary to take that role seriously, and you have the background to do it. But it struck me that these two instances were civilian secretaries being involved in individual personnel decisions in ways that I found a little bit unusual. I've only been on the committee for 7 years, and perhaps it's been more common. But should you be confirmed, what do you think your responsibilities are with respect to personnel matters? Because if I were in the ranks as a sailor, the notion of a political appointee being directly engaged in individual personnel actions for people sort of far down the chain of command, I would be concerned about that. How will you approach this issue should you be confirmed?
Senator, as you and I discussed yesterday, I've had the great good fortune to have served under some great Secretaries of the Navy. John Layman comes to mind. He's a mentor to me. I spoke just the other night with Senator Warner, who, also from your state. Had two conversations with him, in fact, in the last couple of days. Good order and discipline starts with the chain of command. That has been sacrosanct to military forces since the beginning of time. And if I'm confirmed, I will ensure that that is understood from the Secretary's office all the way to the smallest vessel in the United States Navy and the United States Marine Corps. I believe that our commanders, the COs, and ships and commands, are vested with the responsibility to be accountable as well as to lead those who serve under their leadership. And I believe they should be empowered to do such. Again, I have lived my entire life believing in the chain of command, believing in ensuring the chain of command is informed both up and down, and making sure that people have trust and confidence in that chain of command.
Can I ask you, Admiral, Ambassador Braithwaite, in the chain of command, do you see yourself as secretary sort of intervening in personnel decisions that are fairly distant down the chain of command?
No, I don't. I believe that the men and women in uniform at all ranks should have the opportunity to, and should have established the ability to ensure that they are making the decisions to lead their men and women appropriately.
Thank you, gentlemen.
What do you think?
Yeah, so that's either Kane or Warner, right, from Virginia. So I think that that Braithwaite gave the right answer, right? He's supposed to put policy out there in conjunction with law, and that's how people are selected, and that's how they're put into place. And again, his real, where he can twist the knobs and pull the levers, is at the 3- and 4-star level. Interesting, I'll say, you know, a little inside baseball. So the Senate confirms, I think, all 04 and above promotion boards. And there have been individual senators who've got involved way down the chain of command in people who've appeared on promotion boards and basically blacklisted them. The guy who was, I think, CEO of the Blue Angels at one time had been implicated in the whole tailhook roll-up. He ended up being exonerated, but he was shown there, and the guy could never get promoted to captain because someone on the Senate Armed Services Committee blacklisted him. And I know of names when I was in the ACMEX office, people that had been accused, been exonerated, it didn't matter, don't even bother to forward that guy's name on a list over here, kind of a thing. So it is a little, it's hypocritical. And so if that was, they've been on the committee, it could either be Kane or Warner that was saying that. But yeah, he gave, the guy gave the right answer. I would have been careful about the unequivocal no, I won't be involved in that. Because you know what? At some point, I'm not going to allow that sort of statement to put me in the box. Because sometimes, what's the use of being the boss if you know something is wrong and people are doing it? And you know what? You may have to reach down there and fix it.
Well, and again, I say this. I mean, you look at, I mean, when the President of the United States gets involved, you know, you probably, you know, ought to be involved too. And you know what I'm saying? So we've seen in the Gallagher case, you know, we've seen in, you know, the acting Secretary Motley, you know, and what prompts this? It's this higher visibility that it becomes a national issue. A Navy issue becomes a national issue. The crew of that 100 guys from the crew chanting Captain Crozier's name as he walks off the ship, right? Turns that video turns that event into something, you know, it never should have been. But the power of that, and I agree with you, and so it's like, well, I'd love to give you the answer that you want, Senator. But if I just look back in history here over the course of 6 months, you know, maybe this is too probably frank of an answer for public viewing. But if the Gallagher case explodes, I normally wouldn't get involved in that. But I think the Secretary of the Navy at some point had to. Right.
And then also let's think back to Marines United.
Oh, yeah.
They had the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps up there blasting him. Right. Wire brush to the face because the Marine Corps didn't come out strong enough on that. So, look, your critics are going to try and have it both ways. I think he said everything the right way, but I would not have given the unequivocal no.
Right.
I would have said, I run this by this theory, but extraordinary circumstances occur, and I would hope that you would have the confidence in me to know when things are extraordinary and need my particular touch. And the other part of it is, you know, it's interesting that the when the senator uses the word political appointee, he uses it as a pejorative, right? But that's the basis of the United States, is that we have civilians in charge of things. I find that interesting. When he said political appointee, that was not a compliment to the people in charge, right?
For those of you who don't know what pejorative means, right? Expressing contempt or disapproval. Just for the record.
Pejorative was accurate in that, in my use of it, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, normally that's not a compliment.
No, and that's, you know, the senator is he's taken one of the bedrocks of how the nation has survived and turned it as sort of an insult. Because why? Well, it's the current political environment. All you political appointees are bad people. Because your boss is a person.
And that's right? Not necessarily true.
No, it's not. But the senator, in that moment, that's the implication that he's putting out there.
Got it. Email. Mac, interesting stuff this morning. I don't know anybody else who's done a deep dive on the new SecNav, so congratulations. My question for Will is this. What do you hear about him from classmates? We know you ring knockers talk. Do you hear positive things? He seems like a pretty well-rounded guy in terms of ambassador. So he's checked the political block. Business, he seems to have done all right there, and certainly rising to the rank of admiral. He's still a young guy. That speaks well of him, too. What do you hear about him? All right.
So yeah.
Give us
I don't
dirt.
Hear anything about him, but I'll set up a few things here. So he was class 84. I was class 85. I didn't know him. If you think about it, Gilday is class of 85. So this guy is just a year older than the CNO. And there's plenty of 3 stars and 4 stars in the Navy that are in those interim classes. And I think the vice CNO that just got nominated might have been class of 80. But I could be wrong on that. My numbers might be off. And so on the surface, it's a great bio. But so he, I think he served 14 years of active duty, and then he went into the reserve as a PAO. Then he was, I think he worked in operations in a company, but then I think he got into public affairs in a company, but I'm not sure of that either. I tried to read his bio on Wikipedia and there wasn't quite the detail.
I should have known the nice suit, the good hair.
So put yourself in the shoes of the uniforms. And John Layman had some of the same sort of issues. He was a young guy. He was a lieutenant commander in the reserve. So the guy, let's take the Navy admiral who's been slugging it out at sea, long tours, doing what you expect him to do. Now he's a vice admiral, and he knows the Navy inside and out. Well, the gentleman who, you know, Admiral Braithwaite, although he was an admiral, the idea that he knows the Navy inside and out, that might be a little bit of a stretch, right? He left active duty 20 plus years ago. It's not clear that he's been involved in warfighting policy, Navy policy. I don't know. I didn't do a deep dive. But has he had articles written in the proceedings about operational concepts and budgetary issues? So I have a sense that there are going to be some people in uniform, if he tries to use the credibility of being an admiral with those people, it's going to backfire a little bit. His credibility should come from his wider range of experience in business. Somewhat, I mean, how do you get to be the ambassador of Norway? In a lot of ways, you give a lot of money to a political campaign. I don't know. So he's got an interesting sort of maze to work through. And then he comes right out and says, we got a leadership problem. Basically, all you admirals have been screwing it up. I mean, he's got a bit of a tightrope to walk with these guys based on his biography. You know, that's going to be a dynamic in those rooms. And he's got to find the people that sort of recognize the problem. And he's going to be unable to impose from the top down a regime he wants. You know, the Navy's too big and dispersed and the antibodies gather really quickly to that. So how's he going to build coalitions within the uniforms in the Navy to get whatever his vision is out there? And it's in his biography is going to challenge him somewhat in that respect.
Well, let me just here's a paragraph from his military career. Commissioned in 1984, he was initially selected as a special assistant to the Office of Legislative Affairs on Capitol Hill. He becomes a naval aviator in April of 1986.
Yeah, so that selected as a special assistant, I think, is a little bit of resume padding. If I remember right, in those years, you know, flight school was jammed.
Right, so you went someplace.
People were going to flight school. So, okay, 10 of you guys go here and 20 go there and 50 go there and blah, blah, blah. And oh, you have to be up in OLA. I don't think he was involved in, you know, the subcommittee on military readiness helping to write legislation. I think he was probably in the office as an ensign doing what ensigns do in offices. I'll just leave it at that.
And he becomes a S-3 pilot. Now, for those of you who understand the hierarchy of pilotry, okay, the S3 is not at the top of that mix, okay, just for the record, okay. So I concur with you that the fact that he rose to admiral, probably, you know, obviously a sharp guy, but not, as you said, slogging it out through a career in naval aviation or as a black shoe in the fleet, you know, or a submariner, which are all difficult, rigorous, right, lanes to slug through the Navy in a career. So,
I don't want to be taken that I'm taking shots at the guy's character or anything like that.
But we would call him a pretty boy.
He's going to be challenged inside the service because he's got to get – because he can't supervise everything that's going on all the time. He's got to get those people, you know, those three stars in particular that supervise a lot of the scut work that goes on in the building. He's got to get them on board. And listen, the guy's smart. I don't think he's going to try and play the – well, I was an admiral, so I know better. You know, that shit just, that ain't going to fly. And he's got to be smart enough to know that. And it'll be interesting, though, because he's going to have people that he probably knew well in his class at Navy are 2- and 3-star admirals out there, you know. And some of that stuff matters. Some of it doesn't matter. It should help him break the ice with a lot of people. But his service per se does not give him some great advantage. And compare that a little bit to John Layman.
Well, I would tell you it almost puts him at a disadvantage.
Because it absolutely could.
Those guys that have come through those other pipelines, surface, air, and subs, right, they're going to walk in knowing that they've earned where they've been, and they're going to look at him as not the same. And so his ability to lead leaders, and if he would have gone through one of those other pipelines, maybe he doesn't wind up where he winds up. And they will know that. I mean, I don't. You don't. I mean, but they will know that, and they will form a judgment based on him. And so if he stumbles, right, if he stumbles, yeah, the knives, in my opinion, because of his pipe, his pedigree and the pipeline he went through, the knives will come out quicker.
Yeah, I mean, John Layman is interesting in that he was sort of a naval theorist, right, even though he was a lieutenant commander in the reserve. That wasn't the part of his bio that got him to be the Secretary of the Navy. He was a guy that was involved sort of on the public think tank media side of pushing the direction of the Navy. And that's how he got to be the Secretary. Very different than Ambassador Admiral Braithwaite. And again, he can be successful. Right. Just because he didn't go through that nitty gritty doesn't mean he can't be successful, but he's got to be savvy enough to understand how people are going to view him and how's he going to use that view to sort of jujitsu him and get them to rally to what he wants. Because what he said that he wants, with the exception of ignoring, a big chunk of his responsibility in the Marine Corps, is what we all want. There shouldn't be a fight against that. You still got to get people on board with it and doing it. And in these turbulent times, that's going to be tough.
Well, you know, I would say one of the greatest, if not the greatest, military leader in the last 100 years, in the American military leader, is George Marshall. And he did not have many of the tickets punched that, you know, people would say, if you're going to be that guy, you would have done this, 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 and this. Marshall's career was different. And so I think your point's well made. He can be great, but it's a different skill set. He's going to have to prove that. And just know that those knives are going to come out quicker because they're going to be watching you because you were an S3, you were an S3 pilot. You transitioned to become a PAO. And even in his testimony, when he talks about being on the America when the USS Iowa incident happened, right? He wasn't a naval aviator then. He was a public affairs officer then.
And when he talks about being in combat.
Right. So
one star PAO guy in combat. I didn't see him.
All right.
Maybe that was just me. I wanted the center of the universe in blue diamonds, so I didn't know.
Well, I was, and I didn't see him either.
All right.
I didn't see it. That's because I never looked up most of the day because I didn't want to make eye contact with J.N. Mattis. Right? Right. Constantini? Yeah, I could get a hold of him. Why? Get him down here now. Yes, sir. All right, Will. Anything else you want to get off your chest? Oh, you're going to have to come back again, and we'll talk about Marine Corps force design. Because, first of all, we'll just tease that. Give me a general thought after reading former secretary, former senator, former 1-5 platoon commander, Jim Webb's letter. Pretty interesting when somebody of that magnitude takes on the commandant in public.
Yeah, and when we talk in the future, I don't necessarily want to get into the nitty gritty of the design part of it. It's more about what's driving it from the top, and then how things are going to react. And what you're seeing is, when Webb comes out and. I've been an admirer and a detractor of James Webb over my life, but he very specifically knows what he's doing. He knows that, there's sectors of the Marine Corps Alumni Association out there, and the former four stars cannot go out and disagree with the commandant in public. It's just not what we do. And in the end, it's not going to be helpful. And so beyond the details in his article is a little bit of the messaging. And I would hope that James Webb would have talked to the commandant beforehand. I would hope that he would have. But he knows it's pretty damn powerful within people that care about the Marine Corps when a guy of his pedigree comes out and pretty dramatically disagrees. And the commandant would know that he's probably speaking for more than just himself in that. And you know, we as a Marine Corps, we've lived on paranoia for a long time, and just because we're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get us. And so it's one of the reasons we try to have our knife fights behind the school, not out in front. And so when people that senior and that care about the Marine Corps, as I'm sure James Webb does, decides to have a public knife fight with a commandant, that's a big deal. More so than the nitty gritty of what he puts in there. It's a big deal. And it depends on how you feel and the direction and all like that. It may be, if you believe that the commandant is wrong about what he's going, it might be the savior. You believe the commandant is right about where he's going, then it may impede his ability to get things done, which may be the worst of both worlds. And then the commandant goes full bore on, does something, and then just doesn't get it done. Where do we end up then? Kind of a thing. So, yeah, that's a big deal right there.
I would concur. And again, I'm with you. You know, so I was talking to somebody yesterday, and they said, what I wish Webb had done, though, was laid out his vision.
There
and,
you go.
You know what I mean? But and again, I don't think that – but there's no doubt in anybody's mind that the Marine Corps has got to, you know, I won't say shed the Middle East, because I don't know that we can ever do that as a force if you're going to, you know, respond to the range of military operations. But certainly reorienting and refocusing on peer warfare and the Pacific, there's nobody that doesn't agree with that. So if people ask us, hey, do you want to participate in the OPT that talks about reconfiguring? Absolutely. I don't know what it looks like, but I'd absolutely love to tackle those kind of problems. So the design piece, I agree with you. I don't know the answer. I know that, you know, that we've got to look that way. We've got to orient that way, and we've got to equip ourselves to be a part of that. And so I'm not so much about quarreling about the nuances of it. I think that the broader discussion, right, what to me is interesting is all in on one course of action.
Yeah.
The whole Marine Corps, I just, you know, read that there's an article about the Navy wants to buy 30 of these amphib ships, a crew of 40 sailors, a crew – and then a complement of 75 Marines. Well, 75 times 30 is 200 or 2,235, I think. So where's everybody else? All right? We're running in place on the beach in Okinawa or on the
ship. Beyond that, you saw the details. It's a 200-foot ship.
Right. Right. And so that's the
– I've been on a 600-foot ship in the North Atlantic and didn't particularly care for it.
But to me, I mean, that's all, you know, what we come up with. But, you know, so what do we do with the rest of the force? And what do we tell everybody about the rest of the war plans that the Marine Corps has written into that they would be written out of if you don't come with this set of toys? And so to me, those are all existential issues, because you will talk to senior, you know, Marines, both retired and active duty, who will tell you the first time that we miss a that we miss an event, right, is not going to be good for the Marine Corps, because then our existence gets called into question. And Will said something, and we'll end on this, that somebody else said to me within the last 60 days. And make your comment about money, and we'll end on that today as a tease.
Yeah, you know, inside the Pentagon, it's not all about the money. It's only about the money. And if you don't have the money, you're not going to exist in the end. And look, I don't want a Marine Corps because I was a Marine and, you know, I like that, et cetera. I want a Marine Corps because I think it's critical to the nation's defense, and the demise of the Marine Corps is not good for the nation. And so, you allow yourself, you give the money away and you allow yourself to be downsized. It's bad for the Marine Corps. I can get over that, but I think it's bad for the nation. So that's where I am.
Will Cosentini. What's on the agenda for the rest of the day? As you is Missouri still self isolating?
I don't know. I don't live in Missouri.
How about Kansas?
I believe that the governor's order on the most stringent things expired on Sunday, and I think we're into this phased reopening, which really is somewhat irrelevant. The idea that you can put 25% of your capacity into a restaurant really doesn't help anything. And I'll tell you something. I don't know if you're seeing it there. We're seeing empty storefronts here. There are businesses that have gone out of business. And that stuff is obviously always churning, but it's noticeable here. Empty storefronts going on. And this is bad. I think I caught a clip of the guy that you had in the first hour there. And a little personal story. I went and got a physical yesterday. So I called my doctor last week, and the person said, well, she's not doing physicals. And I said, well, I always get my physical in April, and now I've delayed it till May. She said, well, she's going to do them in July. And I said, I really don't want to wait till July. Well, let me see if someone else will do it. I don't want someone else to do it. I got a doctor. So the doctor did my physical, and then I think the guy that you had on rattled off the stats about people not doing screening, cancers not being detected.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
Being used. We go insane, and everyone in the NFL wears pink, you know, cancer awareness, early detection. Well, no one's got a mammogram in the last 6 weeks.
Right. So the number he threw out, and his name's Atlas. He was on with Martha McCallum. I had seen him before somebody else, and he was talking about where all this data is taking us. And so I've kind of followed him, and I saw him again last night. And he says, look, 180,000 people are diagnosed with cancer on a monthly basis. That hasn't gone on for 2 months. He said 2/3 of children are not being vaccinated. That's a real number, and it's a big number across the country. And he said, and then what did he say? 2/3
of chemo patients are not
doing chemo because they don't want to come to the hospital.
You have cancer,
right?
And you're not taking your drugs. See, I saw something where Merck put out the demand for chemotherapy drugs was down, you know, an incredible number.
Right.
Last week sometime.
And the conclusion is the cure, right, is worse than your illness. And he said, and that's what we're creating here with this mentality that we have to wipe this COVID thing out. COVID, it's going to exist along with other competing priorities, and you need grown-ups and leaders. And the problem in the political realm, we don't have so much leading.
It's a classic thing though, who made the decisions? Did a broad base of people involved with different portfolios of life come together and make a risk-based decision? No. We put it in a hand of experts, and the mantra was we have to listen to these medical experts. Well, Dr. Fauci is on record saying he really doesn't care how many people are unemployed. And we've moved the goalposts. In Kansas, the reason we were given stay at home is to flatten the curve. Well, In half of Kansas, there is no curve because there's no cases. And the rest of the state, the curve has been flat. But now it's, we've got to have a certain amount of testing. We got to have this. We got to, you know, we move the goalposts.
Right.
And we're on the road to Abilene.
No, and again, I've said this before, but in the time I was elected, when you ask for the public health officials' solution to it, right, they'll take it to zero, and there won't be anybody around left because nobody will have a job.
There you go.
And that should be, and you know, that's what they advocate for. But what happens is you get put on TV, and then you get asked those questions. Well, do you believe that that you're going to ask citizens to choose between their livelihood and their health? And you know, and you see the governor of the state of New York say, I'll never ask New Yorkers to make that choice. Right? And it's like, no, you have to. You have
to. And not only that, you've just made the choice for him and you don't care.
Bro, he's having a tough time getting around his order that, you know, senior living facilities had to take.
He's killed.
Yeah. He
does, if not hundreds of New Yorkers.
Yeah, he accelerated and enhanced that death number. So
yeah, and look, the median age across the country is probably 80. That means half the people who've died are over 80. So nursing homes, assisted living are responsible for what? At least a third, if not 40-45% of the deaths.
Well, and what Dr. Atlas would say, look, we're protecting the wrong people, right? Yeah. We're protecting the people that this will wash through, and we didn't do anything about the people that were most vulnerable.
If 2 years ago you would have said, well, the flu's coming, who's most vulnerable? You and I would have figured out it's old people in nursing homes and people that have some other illness. Okay, what do we do to protect them? We didn't do anything. And now we have normal, adult, healthy people strapping masks on their face and terrified when they get within 15 feet of someone else and calling the cops when they see two kids playing pickup basketball. Insanity.
It is. It is.
It's absolute crazy. Insanity.
It's crazy. That's why, you know, you root for states like Georgia that opened and did it quick. And what you hope to see is, yeah, will the number of cases go up? Yeah, but that's irrelevant. Of course it will.
Look at Florida.
They're doing all right.
The demographics in Florida skew to be high risk for this, but their death rate per thousand is an order of magnitude less than it is in New York.
Yeah.
And they didn't go the insane route. So what's on my agenda for the day? Avoid watching the news. It's mental health.
Which promotes my mental health. All right. I will be in touch and we'll come back and we'll do the forest design piece.
I can hardly wait to talk to you.
There you have it. Will Cosentini, Colonel, United States Marine Corps. No, he's a smart guy. So there's a deep dive on the prospective Secretary of Navy. And interesting. I learned. I did not know he was an S-3 pilot. Yeah, that's like a few steps down the ladder. So what's the top? What's the top? Well, obviously, you're jet pilots, right? So in my day, that would have been F-14, F-18. Right behind that were guys who flew the A-6. So we're talking about the FA community, the Fighter Attack Squadron community. Okay, everybody, so that the Fs and the As morphed into one platform, which was the F-18. So you're either in the F-18 community, fighter attack, or you're not. Beyond that, S3? Yeah, that's down the road a little bit. So interesting. No, interesting conversation. If you're just tuning in hour one, I talk about Australia is being blackmailed by China. Because Australia asked for an international inquiry into the origins of the COVID-19 virus. They had the unmitigated gall to seek the truth where China's involved. China's response is, we're not buying any more of your beef. To hurt them economically so that Australia will capitulate and play the emperor's new clothes. Now, one of the things to me that I've talked about, and to me it has to do with the initiative in the U.S. initiative in the region of the South China Sea is this. The United States, in conjunction with the European Union, Canada, Mexico, and the great free nations on the planet, South Korea, needs to create something for people, free nations that are set upon by China's economic blackmail, and open that door and say, look, our economies are four times the size of those idiots, right? And the world needs to do it for Australia, because you already have, I think, one of their economic ministers saying, oh, no, this is not related to us asking for an international inquiry. Come on. Of course it is. So you're going to hear me talk about that. You're also going to hear me talk about a little bit about the using all the techniques that China's developed to steal military technology. They're now attempting to steal whatever pieces they need, right, to develop a vaccine for COVID-19. Actively looking to steal that technology, because they believe that if they could be the first to provide the vaccine, you know, that's another brick in the wall of eclipsing the United States, right, as a great power here on the planet. The other thing we'll talk about is if you were not alive for Watergate, get ready. Get ready, because Obamagate's going to be a real thing. And Will and I had an interesting little conversation at the start of this hour about, you know, the President of the United States involved in a conspiracy, right? As his administration circumvented the rule of law, then as he organized those people that would stay on in a new administration, not to speak of this, right, actively a part of it. So that's going to come out. So if you weren't alive for Watergate, stand by. Because this is about to get most interesting. Most interesting. And so you'll hear about that as well. We'll check a few news headlines as well. So on a Tuesday, tomorrow you're going to hear a second installment of a battlefield study, Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, during Operation Buffalo. And last time I had Ray Linebaugh on, Ray, we talked about the events of July 2nd, 1967, when Bravo Company got ambushed, and the single greatest loss of life in any operation by a Marine company during the Vietnamese War, Bravo Company 19. Alpha Company tries to get to them, and then Alpha Company is set upon. And so Ray was a part of that. So, however, right, the fight didn't end there. They had to then continue to fight, and they go back out on July 6th and 7th, and they lay the wood to an NVA unit that's coming into the DMZ. So we're going to tell that part of the story in part two. So and then the other thing we're going to talk about is Ray's a minister, I had to sneeze, and so what happened when he came home? And that's always another part of the interesting parts of these things. Tell me the road that gets you where you're at. So don't miss that tomorrow. On a Tuesday, All Marine Radio, over and out.